I think they like you, Steve.
Hello, hi, welcome to Taco Tuesday.
Live from the Allstate Skyline Studio.
It's the Steve Cochran Show on 720 WGN.
Have no place to go, darling. Good morning, Chicago, 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman here. It's the Steve Cochran Show. Dave Ennis, Mary Sandberg, Mary Vandeveld, Steve Rozanich here. Steve's on his way. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Here this September 11, 2018. You heard in Vic's newscast a lot of remembrances and memorials today, including here in Chicago, some firehouses doing some remembrances because a lot of firefighters from Chicago made the trip to New York to help with what ended up being one of the most tremendous moments in American history. And you'd think the things they must have seen, you know, sort of cobbling through and cleaning up after that deadly terrorist attack. So there'll be a lot of those stories today in Chicago and remembrances of this day back in 2001. Of course, we'll have some stuff as well here on 720 WGN. Good morning. How is everybody?
Good.
Great. Yeah. You guys okay? Are you recovered from the golf outing? I know the three of you were out golfing yesterday. Golfing's not the way you say it, right?
Play golf. Yeah.
We were participating in an amateur golf outing.
Beautiful day for it.
Yeah. It was a great day.
It was really pretty.
The Blackhawks Foundation Four Feathers Golf Outing, which is a great event every year out at Medina Country Club. We had a great time out there.
Who won? Is that how it works?
It's not about who wins. Right, Steve?
Between the three of you.
Well, it's not about winning if we don't win.
Right. Well, that was my point.
I'm not sure because we didn't stay for the awards. So I'm guessing we played.
Well, because the awards go on till 7.
No, like 8. I think Pat got, my husband was there, and he didn't get home until like 9.
Are you guys one crazy? Who is up is that hour?
Well, how do you know
you guys
didn't win
one team?
Yeah, we were a team, and we were matched with Cliff Coral.
What a good guy, by the way.
Yeah, he was amazing.
And he's had back surgery like 10 minutes before the tournament.
And he still had the most beautiful swing.
Yeah.
It's
almost as if he were a professional athlete.
Yeah.
But a nice group. Nice group. And Rocky Wirtz was out there signing his book. Mm-hmm. This is a book called The Breakaway. And Sandberg's going to review it.
I am. I'm going to read it.
Rocky asked me why you would not buy a copy of his book.
Because Jay Blunk brought one for me.
Okay, well, I guess that answers that.
No, Blackhawks have a great organization, a tight family organization, and everybody's out there supporting us today.
There was a lot of players.
There were a lot of players.
I don't know if you guys noticed this, but the hockey player, I think, is the most fit athlete.
You know what? I didn't notice.
Their lower bodies, their legs, and their calves are, because they were all in shorts. I guess I don't usually see them in shorts is probably what it is. You know, Patrick Kane, et cetera. Like, they are, it's a muscly, like, perfection.
Let me go to Dave on that. Dave, did you notice any of that?
I was thinking, you know, muscly perfection was exactly the term that came to mind, Steve.
Yeah. I mean, even that guy from the Ice Hogs that we talked to at the end there, Henrik. I forget his last name. Yeah, he was, I mean, they're just bursting with muscles. There's no fat anywhere on any of them. Yeah. When I guess golf attire right now is the more fitted shirts.
Compression shorts and fitted shirts.
Yeah, so everyone looks like slim. But I have a question about golf course food. There was a lot of amazing food. Bub City had food like on every hole and things like that. Both you and Cliff Coral enjoyed a...
Bratwurst.
Well, a bratwurst, but a chilled Snickers. And I was thinking...
I don't know that I enjoyed it. I took one bite and gave it up.
Okay, well, Cliff Coral...
hard on your teeth.
Coral ate one as well. And I was thinking, why is the cold Snickers on every golf course?
Because they'll melt.
I know, but why Snickers? Like, I do a lot of other...
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Like, why isn't it a granola bar or, you know, like, fruit snacks or something? Like, why is it a Snickers?
I don't know.
Because I do a lot of other things, and Snickers, cold Snickers isn't at every other outing I go to outside of golf. Like, why is that the golf go-to?
Is Snickers the most popular chocolate? I don't know.
I'm not sure, but
especially with the peanut allergy thing. So yeah, right. Now you think it wouldn't be anymore.
It's Mary. It is on every golf course.
It is.
Ever.
You're right.
Snickers, and it's not like there's a bunch of candy.
My
it's
son would lose his mind if he was on that golf course. Why is there so many Snickers? He would
it's
lose it.
Snickers, Kit Kats, and that's the list. It's Kit Kats and Snickers.
I'm just curious.
About I don't know. There's no answer.
Right. And I thought like Caddyshack, but that was a Baby Ruth, right? That was in the pool, I didn't know if it came from
and
that.
I doubt the whole golf world etiquette would be around that movie, right?
You never know.
You never know. Too, but.
Anyway, thanks, Blackhawks.
And if for those of people listening, Dave Ennett hit a shot that hit the Kettle One tent. So,
what? When did that happen?
He's a cocktailer. And,
how did I miss that happen?
Well, you were talking to Savvy, and it
that's
was
after
just,
Savvy
Dennis Savard tried to kill me.
Yes,
right. Dennis Savard, legendary Chicago Blackhawks. I'm going to brought this up. I was going to let him off the hook. Par three, the green is easily hittable, but no, he chose to hit me. I'm 30 yards left of the green. The
you
ball
were teeing off. It really came, and they say four, but you don't always know where it's
if
coming.
If I had not been bent over putting my tee in the ground.
You?
Went flying over my head, just inches from me.
Oh, I thought it actually hit
it really
you. You sounded like a victim there.
It
you
really
sound,
was
I'm lucky
feet.
To be alive.
It stopped you in your drive, though. You had to back off and then reposition.
I had
to
think about everything. I had to ponder life.
But on that hole, Dave Ennett hit his ball, and it hit the Kettle 110. I think he just wanted to go retrieve his ball at the cocktail stand. So
you ever been hit by a drive?
A couple
Does
of
that
times.
Hurt?
Oh, yeah, a lot.
Ugh.
Yeah, a lot.
Maybe that could be our next video. We can throw golf balls at Justin so you could see if
I
the
just
ball.
Want to know what the real game experience
I'll leave a
is
mark.
Like. Yeah.
Dave, I don't want to do a whole bunch of booze jokes here.
No, but, of course not.
But, you know, the Wirtz Family Beverages, mm-hmm. that's where the money was made. And they all had bags of booze, tiny mini hotel refrigerator bottles on the golf cart seats.
It was a cute little Crown Royal bag with a Blackhawk logo on it.
Right. Yes. And inside were several bottles.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't drink.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, who wants a bag of booze?
Right.
And you dove for it.
I know. Okay, that's just, that
cart.
Is so untrue.
You smacked it out
I
of my hand.
I believe it was claimed by our friend Bob Vorwald from WGN-TV. Claimed
right?
one from you. Yes, it was not me.
It wasn't you.
It was not me.
Okay.
I did take our boss Larry was unfortunately couldn't come, and so I took his bag.
Okay, so she has two, and you're
I did.
You're
I know.
Giving me,
but I had to hide it in my
stuff.
Purse, so Dave didn't take
I
it.
I think that you shouldn't pass on that stuff. I think you should bring it for the peons back on your show.
Yeah,
I mean, you got me and Joe and Mary.
It's just when I need you people drunk.
Just I go over to Walgreens,
we'll
buy the same
show.
Bottles.
Yeah,
if
and
you
just
like.
Put it on the communal table and see who gets
yes.
it first.
Gets
I don't think that's what I need, drunken engineers.
We'll be like little squirrels.
Justin was talking about the anniversary of 9/11. More on that, obviously, to come. Tim O'Brien later, one of the chief critics of Donald Trump, and happens to know him better than anybody. Kid of the Week this morning, Dean Richards later. And then at about 8:30 or so, I'm going to be vacating the premises. Our friend John DeCoste lost his dad, and the services are this morning. So we'll talk about that when he comes in later in the week. But Justin, it's all you and the kids at, you know, the kids on the show.
Mm-hmm.
You've met everybody, right, haven't you?
The kids all right, yeah.
From the Steve Cochran Auditorium in the lovely Sunrise Hotel, it's time to get your kicks.
Get your kicks.
Don't get your kicks.
With the top 666, sponsored by American Weathermakers Heating and Cooling, the 60 Minute Men.
It is 6:22, and here we go. A strike currently affecting 25 downtown Chicago hotels.
That's it.
Is the first broad hotel strike the city has seen, according to the union that called it. Started Friday. The union says it'll go on until the hotels agree to the demands. It's putting hotels in a bind. These are which hotel workers? Because there's different unions.
Yeah,
in
I'm not sure what the union is, but on Saturday we were downtown, and it felt like it was more than 25 hotels. Every block in the Mag Mile and downtown had a picket line in front. A lot of activities, and it's amazing to me to know how strong a union could be to to put picket lines in front of this many hotels.
Well, what they need to do is get off the picket lines for a second and work on the PR, because they have not done a good job of putting out the message about what they're upset about.
It's the housekeepers, doormen, cooks, bartenders.
No, you have been reporting it in the news, but it's not common knowledge. It's not living on the internet the way it should be.
Yeah, there was a piece today in the Tribune, room service attendants and more, and they... it's the ones that they want benefits for people year-round, even the employees that get laid off when it's in a slow time. So that's what they're looking for.
And I would assume...
Unite Here Local 1 is the union name.
I would assume they... I mean, I would just assume, being room service attendants and the like, you would assume that they probably have a point. Whatever it is, I don't know what it is. I'm not paying attention to the story, but those people they historically underpaid, historically under-benefited.
And we've not seen the books of the hotels, but occupancy in Chicago hotels have been through the roof.
Yeah. So. But it is really startling, because they've got the little clackers and the drums. And when I walked Michigan Avenue from Water Tower down to the old Trib Tower, and it was just a cacophony of sound from all.
Have you stayed at the Hotel Cacophony?
It's really
a boutique
strange
hotel.
It is, but again, they're having a hard time changing the sheets because the picket line out front.
They are. Literally, people can't check into their rooms and things at all these hotels because they don't have enough staff to...
Oh, I can't have
that. I just keep thinking, like, of the manager at the hotel who's like, I've got to do what now? I've got to go in there. What do you do? Do I replace the soaps? Do I not replace the soaps? What does it mean if towels are on the floor? Like,
I have a friend who runs a bunch of hotels in the South. Maybe he'll know.
Yeah.
Maybe that's like a hotel newsletter that goes out to everybody. Right.
There's it's the Hilton Hotels, Palmer House, Doubletree, Hyatt, Park Hyatt, Marriott International, Westin, W Lakeshore. Yeah.
Intercontinental on there?
Sheraton. I do not see your Intercontinental.
Super 8?
One visitor from Dallas, we spoke to the Associated Press yesterday, said it took 8 hours to check into the Palmer House Hilton.
Well, that wouldn't be too frustrating, would it?
Yeah. Why would you wait?
At $300 a night, you'd expect things to go more smoothly, he said.
You wonder if the hotels not only are going to have to deal with replacement workers, but have to deal with some sort of discount to the people who are staying there, paying that kind of coin and getting less than stellar service.
Well, not if the workers want money.
Yeah.
Next. Attorneys for Jason Van Dyke off to a rocky start during jury selection for the murder trial. The judge threatened to hold one lawyer in contempt for obstructing justice. It's not entirely unexpected. It just was a little nastier than expected. And, you're going to get news out of this trial every day. Next. More than 1 million residents and tourists being urged to evacuate. Most are doing so. 1.5 million from the entire coast of South Carolina are about to be under a mandatory evacuation as Hurricane Florence bears down. The latest computer models seem to indicate that it's more of a northerly pattern, and the people of Virginia, including Norfolk and Hampton Roads, are in the literal way of the storm here. So we'll keep an eye on it throughout the day. And as this thing develops, Thursday, Friday seem to be the worst days in regards to, you waited too long. Maybe you know somebody in the South who and on the coast who lives there. A lot of people go, it's such a pain to evacuate. You get in the car, you drive for 2 or 3 hours, and it may rain really hard inland, and there could be a flood there. You can't tell people what to do, but once you're in it, and even in mandatory evacuation zones, the authorities can't get to you to save you. So,
well, you just we talked about this last year with Florida, right? I mean, there was a lot of question about where do you go. And then you also we had guests who were on the program who talk about they're living paycheck to paycheck and missing work and having prolonged...
We're going to have to worry about work if you die.
No, true, but I mean, there really is no... It's not like they can just go 3 hours and then check into a hotel. They don't have the money for it. So where do you go if you have to do a mandatory evacuation?
Don't know.
So a lot of people make those choices based on that.
Next, Mitch Trubisky only threw one pass to the left, so the internet's having some good times. They're calling him Zoolander. Remember Derek Zoolander couldn't go left? Same thing.
That's awesome.
And Mitch is attractive. So there you go. It works on both levels.
Blue Steel? Is that the...
Blue Steel is playing tight end now.
And who's that Cub pitcher that can't throw to first?
John Lester.
John Lester.
Yeah, so we've got a quarterback that can't go left, and there's a pitcher in town that can't throw to first.
That's not good, and that's his left side.
Gas fight!
I have lunch news for you. The Subway $5 footlong could be going away from your local Subway store. Subway says, we'll leave it up to the franchises.
Oh, that's a mistake.
It's a problem. Let's go live to Steve, who's vice president of food on the show. Steve, how do you feel about this?
I think it's a big mistake. It's one of the only reasons, well, not one of the only reasons, but the big reason why I go to Subway on a regular basis is the $5 footlong. And if it goes away, so do I.
That's what I'm talking about.
Well, how, I mean, obviously, $5 for our sandwich is a huge steal.
Yeah, that's their big complaint, is the profit margin. That's the franchisees don't like
that. And if you're forcing it from the, you know, from the network, quote-unquote, network down, yeah, I could see why a lot of people would be like, I can't make money off of this. Make it $7 foot long. Would you be okay with
what
that,
kind of
Steve?
Song is that?
$7
foot.
Yeah, no, it doesn't work.
It doesn't work. Yeah.
Close.
Yeah.
And on this anniversary of 9/11, I urge you, as I often do with stuff like this, not that there's anything really like this, talk to your kids. Think about this. A child that was born that week is graduating from high school. A kindergartner that year is now graduating from college. This is the next generation. And how much do they know about what it felt like to be you on 9/11? Yeah. So talk to your kids about it, and we'll talk more about it as the show goes on. And see if there's any way that in this country that's so divided, we can get back to where we were on the Capitol steps just days after 9/11.
What blows your mind,
as
Steve,
one team,
is that for adult generations, they teach this in school. This is something that Miles comes home with. Last year, he's talking about 9/11, and it's a chapter, you know, in America, obviously, but it's a chapter in American history that gets taught to grade schools all over the country.
Well, it should be.
Yeah, of course.
But at home, we don't want to talk about unpleasant things to our kids. And the most impact you're going to have is from a parent or a grandparent, especially on a younger child.
Yeah.
And you need to take the opportunity. Talk about why it mattered, what it felt like to be you, and what it means to your family. All right, 6:30. We'll come back with the headlines in a moment. Kid of the Week still to come on 720 WGN.
That's it!
That's all today for the Top 6 at 6.
No more!
Sponsored by American Weathermakers Heating and Cooling, the 60 Minute Men.
The Steve Cochran Show presents The Kid of the Week.
God bless the child.
Oh, and I forgot to mention Bob Woodward's book Fear is out today. Oh, wait, this is the Kid of the Week segment. Kid of the Week, every week, great kids doing great things. Good things, medium things, and phenomenal things. Whatever kid is getting over the hump and doing good things in this world, we want to know about it. Go to WGNradio.com and tell us about a Kid of the Week. Like, joining us on the telephone right now, Nina. Let me get on the phone and say hi, Nina. Good morning, Nina.
Good morning.
How old are you?
I'm 10 years old.
All right, and what do you do for a living?
I travel, and I'm lucky enough to go to a lot of places with my family, and I like to play on the trampoline, and I love to make slime.
Well, that's cool. All of that is cool, from slime to travel to family. 10 years old would put you in fourth grade?
Fifth grade.
Fifth grade, okay. What do you want to be when you grow up?
I want to be an orthodontist because you can help kids feel better about their smiles, and you can help them put on braces and they can feel better at their smile.
That's a very specific thing. Do you know an orthodontist, or do you have one that you, a family member or something?
So I go to the orthodontist because I used to have braces on, and I really like how they do it, and I thought it would be a really cool experience to go.
It's very nice of you. You don't mind putting your hands in people's mouths?
Well, you wear gloves.
Oh, that's a very good point. I didn't think about that.
Hey, Nina, when you had braces, did you pick different color bands?
I picked colors every month.
Oh, wow, every month.
Now, are your braces off already?
Yeah, and I have a retainer.
And how do your teeth look? Do they look fabulous?
Yeah, they're very straight.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I have twin brothers, Nico and Luca, and they are 9 years old. And I have one little sister, Sophie, and she is 7 years old.
Oh, my goodness. That's
are you dating anyone currently?
3 years. Like,
no.
That's a lot of kids in that house.
There's a lot of kids. I'm just wondering, is Miles still single?
He is single, yeah.
Well, Miles, I don't know. Do you like the name Miles, Nina?
I don't know.
Okay.
Nina, I have a question for you. I know, because my son is now in sixth grade, but I know in fifth grade, homework starts to become a big issue, and they start to get a little bit more serious about school. Are you noticing that in your first couple weeks?
So at our school, we don't have homework for math, and we just have to do practicing a poem every week, and then we have to read for about 30 minutes. That's it.
That's very good. But are you concerned you're not learning enough?
Well, on the weekend, sometimes I get homework, like social studies homework and stuff, but I just have to finish it for a grade, so it's okay.
Do you read for fun?
Yeah, I this year I was in the summer reading program, and I got a lot of cool prizes from doing it, and it was really cool, and I read every day.
I think fifth grade's one of the best ages. Fourth, fifth, sixth grade, I think that's one of the best ages. Don't you, Nina?
For next year.
Nina, is it because you like reading that you wanted to volunteer at the library?
Yeah, because when I was little, I saw all the kids volunteering, and I thought it was so cool, so I wanted to do it, and I wanted to try it, so I got to help everyone at the library, and I thought it was really cool for everyone to have some help from me.
All right, so you took the initiative to create slime this summer. What does that mean?
So basically, slime is something where you can use it for stress, like if you're stressed out of work, and I would love to make you slime and hand deliver it to you, but slime is basically something where you can use it for fun or for a stress reliever, and you can make it how fun you want. You can add glitter, colors, scents, and whatever you want.
So it can be stylized. Now, you're not old enough to remember this, but there used to be shows on Nickelodeon where you would make slime. Is that the same sort of thing?
Yeah, so there's a show called Double Dare, and I watch it a lot, and they, make slime, and they dump it on your head.
Yeah. Is yours similar?
No, because theirs is always green.
Yeah, their slime is runnier. You know, the slime that all the kids are doing now is
Nina's slime is like a stress ball?
It's more like, silly putty. It's Nina, are you allowed to make it? Do you have a special room in your house? Because slime's been made in my house, and it can be messy, so are you allowed to do that anywhere in the house?
So I make it outside usually because I don't want to make my house messy, and I just keep it on the main floor and use it in the kitchen.
What a good kid you are.
You know, Nina was withholding because we asked what she does for a living, but one of the big jobs that Nina has is she's a crossing guard at her school, and she takes the role very seriously. Nina, what's the secret to being a good crossing guard?
So you don't just want to stand there and say, you can go, you can go. You want to actually say, good morning, how are you doing today? And the parents, they're really happy, and it's just really nice to hear them.
Well, plus, I'm sure they like seeing you. You got a big smile on your face, and it makes the stress of crossing guards or stress of picking up your kid or dropping your kid off less stressful.
Yeah, and I make some kids' days because sometimes they're really scared. Because when I was little, I was really scared to go to school. So, I think it's a really cool thing to help little kids that are going through that.
Now, if any cars don't pay attention, do you whip a slime ball at their car?
No.
No, that's good. That'd be a bad idea. Nina, you're a phenomenal young lady. How do I pronounce your last name?
Magus.
Nina Magus. Nina, you are well-deserving of Kid of the Week honors. What has she won?
You have won a Lou Malnati's gift card for some pizza and an app gift card so you can go buy some headphones or something.
App.com and LouMalnati's.com.
Can we just bring up two other things? So the slime Nina was making, she sold it and then she gave the proceeds to Ronald McDonald House, right, Nina?
Yes.
Well, that's
and
very
then
nice.
The other thing is she has been chosen as a writer for a local teen magazine, Raise Your Bar, under the her title is The Chronicles of Narnina.
Very nice.
So that's pretty impressive. She's very already nice. Writing it in fifth grade. Yeah.
Well, she's
that's
already amazing. Writing for a teen magazine. She's 10.
Yeah, so it's pretty cool.
You're ahead of your time, Nina.
Thank you so much. I can't even describe how excited I was.
Oh, you're a great kid. You really are.
Can we talk to Nina every week?
Yeah, Nina, if I like your idea of bringing a slime. So if you find yourself downtown, preferably with your parents, come in and see us.
I would love to.
Have a great day at school. I know you will.
Thank you. You too. Have a good day at work.
You know, that's the thing.
Wow.
That's the thing why I like fourth, fifth, and sixth graders.
Gosh.
Because there's exceptions, but most of them wake up and they can't wait to get the day going.
That was the most motivational Kid of the Week of all time.
She needs to join the Miss America pageant or something.
She's a great kid.
She talks so eloquently.
Very positive kid. So, and you know where that starts. It starts at home. Yeah. You got a positive parents.
And to volunteer to make slime and sell it and give the proceeds to charity, to be a crossing guard, Nina's got going on.
Someday she could be the Warren Buffett of slime. Someday she could have giant factories all over the world making slime.
And, of course, Steve's tried to steer her down a bad road by asking if she throws slime at cars. And did you hear the sound in her voice? No.
Why would I do that? That's right. Dumb. Good kid. We like that kid a lot. As opposed to the other kids we have. No, we like all the kids, but sometimes Kid of the Week can sort of jump out at you.
So if you know any kids that are awesome, please go to WGNradio.com and fill out it's a really quick little Kid of the Week form, and maybe your kid can get picked.
Gosh, my face hurts from smiling from
that. Could be that could be Kid of the Year right there.
Yeah, it's the positivity was tremendous. Right?
You don't know this. Sandberg hates Kid of the Year because she doesn't want to pick one kid over all the other kids.
Well, it's awful. Yeah, why would you?
It's not competition, right?
Which is why you two can make the selection this year.
Oh, no.
I want you all to know it can't go any louder. I want you all to know that America today, is on bended knee in prayer for the people whose lives were lost here, for the workers who work here, for the families who mourn. This nation stands with the good people of New York City and New Jersey and Connecticut as we mourn the loss of thousands of our citizens. I can hear you! The rest of the world hears you, and the people who knocked these buildings down will hear all of us soon.
God bless America!
To everybody who is here, thank you for your hard work. Thank you for making the nation proud. And may God bless America.
The finest moment for George Bush as president. It may be hard to remember this, but he was elected just months before that. President Clinton missed an opportunity to take out bin Laden. That doesn't mean 9/11 wouldn't have happened. We had organizational problems between the FBI and the CIA. That doesn't mean 9/11 wouldn't have happened. But at that moment, there was unity like we hadn't experienced, I would suppose, since maybe the days after Pearl Harbor. And in the days that followed, we were unified and we were together as one. And you just feel like that's something that we have to recapture. And you're wondering if it's ever going to happen. So as the 9/11 celebrations and remembrances in New York City and Chicago and around the country go on today, I hope you'll stop down for whatever busyness you have in your day to pay attention and remember what you felt in those days. One of the most amazing things that struck me then, and it's still pretty amazing, is how many people just dropped their lives and signed up. I'm talking about men and women in their early to mid to even late 20s who said, I'm not putting up with this. This is my country. I'm getting in.
They joined the FBI, went into the service, even to as immediate as volunteering at Ground Zero.
Yep, exactly right. And as you mentioned at the top of the show today, firemen from Chicago and the surrounding area didn't ask. They got into cars and trucks and drove to New York and said, what do you need? Yeah. What do you need? Because I'm here to help. I hope in your lifetime you'll be able to make a trip to New York City in some form to be able to see those memorials. Incredibly moving. And in Shanksville and in Washington, D.C. as well at the Pentagon. Because they are all parts of our history. And I don't know how you've been changed since 9/11, but we all have. And if you have a 9/11 story you'd like to share, you can text that in, 312-981-7200. And I'd like to hear from you at 6:58. Let's do this. We'll come back with the news. But first, coming up, stories that matter. Steve Grzanich in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on 720 WGN Radio.
This is the Steve Cochran Show on 720 WGN.
Here comes the sun, tootin' tootin'. Here comes the sun, and I say, it's all right.
At 7:10, on this 9/11 anniversary, You know, there's a lot we don't know about what happened on that day. And I dug up an old USA Today piece about it. There's still no definitive answer into how all the hijackers got into all the cockpits of all the planes. And one of the theories is that the flight attendants were could have been stabbed. Remember, the box cutter is part of this awful story. And a cockpit door key could have been taken, or one of them, one of the flight attendants may have been hurt, which forced the pilot or the co-pilot to come out, giving access to the door. One of the other things that was interesting is whether it was strategic or not, there were light passenger loads on the planes, and that allowed these inexperienced pilots to be able to maneuver the plane more easily. Because it's fairly remarkable that they didn't crash the plane before they got to the targets. The critical information that came off the planes was that they had been hijacked, because in the early moments prior to figuring out what was going on, navigational equipment on the plane was turned off, so it became impossible to track. So the plane simply just disappeared from the radar. And it was important that these folks on cell phones were able to call and say, this is what's happening. And is that when the pieces started to come back together?
I'm surprised with all of the information that came out after the fact, including interrogations and a war on terror, that information, because that was a training. It was training on how they would get into the cockpit, training on how they would do that. And it's not like they just improvised when they got in there. That information has not been collected by the government and shared with the people.
Flight 93, which, of course, crashed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, there was one hijacker that didn't make his mission because there was an alert TSA, even though they weren't called that back then, but TSA agent who just questioned his papers. Mohammed Al-Khatani was refused entry by a suspicious immigration inspector at Florida's Orlando International Airport. And that was in August, and was not able to make it on that morning on 9/11, so they went one short. That one short was on Flight 93, and because it was Flight 93, one less hijacker made it slightly easier for the passengers to storm the cockpit and force the plane to crash before it could get to Washington. Speaking of that, Vice President Cheney is known to have approved the possibility of shooting Flight 93 down once we knew 93 was another weapon in the air. 40 passengers on board, and Cheney approved shooting it down. But if you remember, the planes that were scrambled to intercept the plane didn't have time to have those planes weaponized. So the two pilots that were flying those Air Force jets were going to have to run into the plane, take it down, and therefore take their own lives. And that was a very active possibility for several minutes that horrible morning. We had many attempts to get bin Laden prior to 9/11, the most famous of which is after the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania were bombed in 1998. President Clinton authorized a cruise missile strike against bin Laden's compound in Afghanistan. He survived, but as you know, was killed by Navy SEALs in 2011. And this is interesting, too, and this is something that's not widely known. The CIA had warned President Clinton about potential hijackings being part of a plot in 1998. The president's daily brief, the PDB you hear about and heard so much about after 9/11, the CIA told Clinton that bin Laden was preparing to hijack U.S. aircraft and other attacks. The plan, the agency said, was to hijack the planes to gain the release of Youssef. Youssef is the guy that had the original attack on the Twin Towers in the early 90s. That all part of the 9/11 report. Saudi Arabia had multiple ties to the hijackers. The Saudi Arabian ambassador to the United States is said to be the link for intelligence that led to the 9/11 attack as well, which again makes you wonder why we haven't done more in regards to our relationship with Saudi Arabia to have Saudi Arabia pay for what they did then. It is still a tangled mess of people we have to work with, people we choose to work with, and people we try to work with. But on this morning of 9/11, we need to remember the heroes, including the Let's Roll men of Flight 93, the innocent men and women who just got up and went to work that day and were killed by cowards.
Wasn't there an issue with President Bush not reading the PDB leading up to 9/11 and not being aware of what was... There was a lot of planning, apparently, that was going on that What was that? I can't recall the exact part of that story.
There's a great documentary that is still available in Showtime's On Demand service about all the CIA heads, including Michael Hayden, who's been on the show many times, and the former CIA heads all talking. And their story, in regards to what you're talking about, Steve, was that they got a hold of Condoleezza Rice on multiple occasions and said, we need to talk to the president. And the president hadn't been briefed, and that hadn't been briefed seemed to come to an understanding that he hadn't dove in with the seriousness that he needed to, and that Cheney and Rumsfeld were handling that side, which led to the long-term opinion and image of George Bush that he was the president in name, but that Cheney and Rumsfeld are running the country. We've since come to find out that's not all true, but certainly that first year of the presidency, there was more concern about the economy and other things than there was about preparing for an attack from Bin Laden, because nobody believed it could happen.
Yeah, and to think about the subsequent years after that, and how, you know, as you mentioned in the last hour about how this country came together, and it was interesting to see an entire, I mean, even today in 2018, the effects of what the American government did to respond. And, you know, we are continuing a war in Afghanistan from September 11th, and of course, a famed war and an occupation, really, of Iraq, which was really pushed through Congress and pushed through the United Nations based on false information, we find out now, but based on this idea that the country was in unity. I mean, even high members of the Democratic Senate and Congress voted to approve the Iraq War based on the idea that this would be a response to 9/11.
Texters from 708, the color of the sky. It was a color of blue that I'd never seen. And the sound of the only planes in the air being stealth bombers on 12-hour missions. I was in school in St. Louis. They left at 7 or 8 a.m., and we left at 7 or 8 a.m. We came home 12 hours later. There's a lot of military bases in and around St. Louis, and that's one of the reasons for those fighter jets. 847, on 9/11, I was a senior in high school. Before our teacher even let us know what had happened, the administrative secretary asked me to step out of the classroom. She told me that my dad's secretary was like an aunt to me. He was on the phone. She told me what happened at the World Trade Center and told me that my dad was on a plane from O'Hare to New York City and she didn't know if he was affected. There was no cell service. I waited in the principal's office for hours, sobbing. Finally, a few hours later, my dad called to say he was heading to New York and ran to get one of the last rental cars at the airport as he was driving home. I was so relieved. My high school told all of my classmates that we could go home with our parents' permission. I asked my dad if he could give me permission to go home. He said, no, why? He said, I'm okay, and you need to keep learning. He told me to be grateful that he was alive, because a lot of other kids aren't going to be so lucky. 224 on 9/11, my son was in daycare, which was located in an FAA building, so it was evacuated at the same time my husband was in D.C. for a conference. He reported seeing surface-to-air missile launchers on the sidewalks, tanks all over. Hotel told them that pretty much everyone was on their own. Took him 2 days to get home by train as it stopped at every bridge to search before continuing. And so it goes. If you have a story to tell, I'd love to hear it. Text us 312-981-7200. God bless America on the 17th anniversary of 9/11. Are you ready for football? On Monday night, it's ready. Yeah, this is Rockin' Randall Hank with a special alert for the nation. Here come the hits, the bangs, the blocks, and the spikes. Friends, drop in on Monday night.
Let's talk some real football here. Ocean Springs, Mississippi. A high school senior had to quickly discard her crown after being named homecoming queen and put on a football helmet. Kaylee Foster was homecoming queen of Ocean Springs High School before Friday night's football game. She then geared up and kicked the winning extra point to lead her team to a 13-12 win over George County High School. She kicked two field goals earlier in the game, which means she was the leading scorer on the team. She's primarily a soccer player, but she's been a member of the homecoming court for 4 years, and she's been kicking with the varsity football team since she was a sophomore. Crown goes back on after the game, I'm sure. She told the Mississippi Press, I was pretty sure I wasn't going to be homecoming queen, but I was pretty sure I was going to make that kick. Kaylee Foster joins us now. Good morning, Kaylee.
Good morning.
You are the most valuable person on the planet. How about that?
Oh, thank you. That's awesome.
So how did you end up playing football? Did the coach approach you because he knew you were such a good soccer player, or did you ask to be a part of the team?
A coach actually approached me because I was good at kickball.
A kickball?
Yes.
I love kickball. I haven't played kickball I haven't played kickball in forever.
I didn't even know they were still playing kickball.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Oh, yeah. We do like a tournament in like the sixth grade. It's crazy.
Oh, wow.
We get into it.
And you got to have a good field to play kickball because the pitcher's got to roll that sucker in there from the pitcher's mound. Nah, it can be nothing but trouble. Or the pitcher's flat in this case. What position did you play in kickball?
I think I was first base.
Oh, see, there you go. This is back to your 16-inch softball nonsense where you have to catch a ball with no glove on.
Oh, yeah.
All right, so when you were asked to be on the football team, were you ready for it and up to it and into it right away?
I was super into it, but I didn't exactly know what I was supposed to do. So I had to, like, go home and look up, like, how to kick a football because I didn't know.
It's very similar to kicking a soccer ball, and it's similar to kicking a, you know, a kickball if you know what you're doing, right?
Yeah, I guess if you know what you're doing, it's kind of similar.
So I don't know much about how homecomings go these days, but it, my thought is that they told you were homecoming queen before you did this, before the game, or was the whole event before the game?
You get announced on the field, don't you, Kaylee?
Oh, yeah, announced on the field. I had no idea.
Yeah, they bring out the court. Yeah, then you're the queen. So you were in, like, a dress or jeans or something?
I was in a dress. I was in an evening gown.
An evening gown.
So you take off the evening gown and get your gear on for football.
Yeah.
That's pretty entertaining.
And then after the game, there's a picture in the story of you in your football uniform holding your flowers, your football helmet, and with the crown back on. So
how great is that?
She resumed her duties right after.
Well, that's great. Now, you're a sophomore?
I'm a senior.
Oh, senior. You were a sophomore when you started. I got it. All right, so what are you going to do next year?
I'm going to go to college and try to major in accounting.
Any idea where you're going to go to school? In other words, can you kick in college?
I think I'm going to go to Mississippi College. I don't think I'm going to kick. I think I'm going to play soccer.
Okay. There you go. Well, you're a great story. Yeah. You're a great story. Have you run into any girls younger than you that wanted to play?
I actually had a little 9-year-old. I was talking to one of the parents after the game on Friday, and he told me that a 9-year-old told her dad that she wanted to be like me when she grew up, and that honestly made me cry. It was the sweetest thing ever. I just can't even believe. Yeah,
it's cool when you inspire others. It's a great story. Well, Kaylee,
yes.
I don't know what to call you, a super jock or queen, but you can respond to both.
Yes, I'll respond to both.
Kaylee, are you the only female on the team? The football team?
I'm actually not. We have another freshman girl who kicks as well. She kicks for our freshman team, and she's awesome.
Do you feel like you are a part of the team totally, you and her, or is it like, oh, these are the two girls on the team?
No, I feel like we are totally a part of the team. They really, like, embrace us. They don't kind of, like, shun us away. Like, we are 100% a part of that team.
Yeah, I think this generation's different in a lot of good ways, including boys this age now. They're not like that. So, you know, and if you can kick and you can kick well and you might help them win, come on.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what they're like.
It's great to talk to you. Congratulations. Why don't we send her, you know, I mean, she's not getting good pizza in Mississippi. Can we send her some Lou's?
We can send her some Lou's.
Let's send you some Chicago pizza. I can't imagine what they're forcing you to eat that they call pizza in Mississippi. All right. Well, congratulations, you multi-talented you. And thanks for being on.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
There you go.
There you go.
You have to make sure that's not an NCAA violation, though, if you send her pizza.
Ooh, I hadn't thought about that.
She's going to play college soccer.
She just has to report it, right? Isn't that the disclosure?
I don't know.
Does it depend on the size of the pizza?
Could be, and also the ingredients.
If it's thin, does it count less than thick?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
If it's just cheese, you're good.
What happened in softball, or alleged losing softball?
Canceled last night. Field's unplayable.
What are you talking about? We played on golf yesterday. It was fun.
I don't know what to say about sometimes the park that we play out at the northwest side doesn't seem to do a good job with raking the field. So it rained, Saturday night? And there was still standing water on the field Monday night.
Where's your grounds crew? Where's your people out there to clean that up?
This is not. I only came in halfway through this season, and based on the complaints that were coming into the Facebook page from the players, this has been a continuing problem with the unsaid park on the northwest side at Diversey and Clay.
Is it possible that this is just Chicago coming to its senses and playing real softball instead of the 16-inch nonsense you're addicted to?
I don't know. I think it's what's more possible is they're like, what? Huh? We're supposed to take care of the fields? What?
Who's in charge of the league? They couldn't get there you another
two,
field.
I know. There are two commissioners. The problem is very kind of political, that Chicago Sport and Social, which is the big, you know, they do all the flag football, things like that. They gobble
beach
up.
Beach volleyball.
Beach volleyball. They gobble up every diamond in Chicago.
Because, can't you pay somebody off in true Chicago tradition?
Well, that's the idea. So then the media league, which is independent, has to find the only ones that are left. So this is the slim pickings that are left. It's kind of an issue that I don't think it's mentioned that much about the privatization of the parks.
Not
have to do with 16-inch softball, but the idea that one company comes in and gobbles up everything, and if I want to play softball on a diamond, I got to pay their price.
At least you have a full week to talk trash about the Trib.
That's true.
Right.
And now we're looking at a doubleheader, playoff doubleheader. Which I do not like that.
Oh, my gosh. Next
I do not
week,
like that.
He's going to be...
Is it a day-night doubleheader so you can clear the crowd in the first one and get both gates?
No, it's a shake hands at the end of one game and start the next.
Wow.
So, like, you have sweaty backs, a lot of sweaty backs for the first inning.
That'd be a good name for your team.
Sweaty backs.
Yeah, the sweaty backs. It's 7:32. We'll come back with your headlines in just a second. And still to come, Tim O'Brien on Donald Trump, the president, his day, and where we're going from here. Here's Tim O'Brien from Bloomberg coming up. News next.
Political disloyalty, it's certainly troubling.
Well,
it's not illegal.
Well, but there's another part of it, though. Every senior official in any administration takes an oath to the Constitution. The Constitution of the United States vests all executive power in the President of the United States. To have an individual who took that oath literally say that they work every day to frustrate the president advancing the agenda he was elected to advance is undemocratic. It's not just deceitful, but it's really an assault on our democracy, and that person should do the honorable thing, step forward and resign.
It's been quite a bizarre time in this last year and a half, and certainly the last week to 10 days feels like it couldn't get any crazier, but I think we both know that's not true. Executive editor for Bloomberg's Opinion at BO Opinion, NBC, MSNBC analyst, and friend of the show, Tim O'Brien, joins us. You've read him in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and of course he's the author of Trump Nation and knows Donald Trump much better than we do. Good morning, Mr. O'Brien.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
How are you on 9/11?
You know, it's I spent a lot of time with firefighters around 9/11, and it's a poignant day because all of us in New York are remembering the sacrifice that they made when the towers came down and the impact it had on the city. It's kind of amazing 17 years on that the focus of attention every day is President Trump, and terrorism seems to have gone out the window as a topic.
And the cowardice in Congress compared to when they stood on the Capitol steps and sang in unison and it looked like we'd never be apart again.
Well, I hope that the country and America thinks about its better angels and remembers that we're a community of people. And whether we're Democrats or Republicans or liberals or conservatives or black and white, we all live together. And at moments in need, we should come together. And we have in the past. I hope we do in the future.
You know, Tim, one of the more amazing things about the psyche of Trump, and it's sort of fascinating, it's like a car wreck. You can't help but look. And I think that's why people talk about it, is that he's a New Yorker. And he was in New York when all of this happened. Now, we know we got the nonsense fake story about all the Arabs that were cheering. But other than that, he doesn't even seem to break from whatever damage he has between his ears and in his heart to understand how important that day was to everybody else. This morning, he's trashing the FBI on Twitter on 9/11.
There's also a Category 4 hurricane heading toward the Carolina coast that may become a Category 5. And the president did not tweet about that, nor did he tweet initially about 9/11. He tweeted about Bob Mueller's Russia investigation. So, but I don't think this should surprise people. The reality of Donald Trump is he is a very self-absorbed person. And what's usually front and center in his mind is self-aggrandizement, or survival. And those are the things that, that really grab his attention most of the time. He is not policy-oriented. He is not a sophisticated manager. The fact that there's chaos in the White House and people in the White House are leaking about it because they're deeply concerned also shouldn't surprise anyone. The Trump Organization was a chaotically run boutique business. It was not a Fortune 500 enterprise. Donald Trump's presidential campaign was chaotic and seat of the pants with very good messaging. And the White House is not being run in a sophisticated way. And again, to me, I don't think this is about ideology or partisan politics, left versus right. It's about good governance. It's about what you would expect out of anyone running a large organization who could and should build a strong team, be fact-oriented, detail-oriented, and get results. And that's just not who he is.
Tim, it's very interesting to think about. We just played in the last hour a clip of President George W. Bush at Ground Zero talking to people. We've heard speeches on this day from other presidents. And frankly, in American history, presidents getting in front, showing their leadership by speaking about the issues of their day or the memories or the memorials of their day. Do we expect that when it comes to leadership from a president? Do we expect President Trump to speak today or to be eloquent about a day like today?
Well, I think historically we've looked to presidents to speak about our joint national goals and inclusion. And the best communicators have been able to do that over the last century, whether that was Franklin Roosevelt or John Kennedy or Ronald Reagan or Bush on 9/11. But President Trump doesn't come from a place of inclusion. His messages are about exclusion, and his messages are about beware of the other and beware of the unknown. Exclude people from coming into the country, build a wall, fear China. He had a horrendously muted and dishonorable message on race after Charlottesville. I don't think any of those things are in the tradition of what this country would point to as great presidents, and presidents from both sides of the political aisle. And I just don't think he has it in him. He also campaigned effectively on it, and I think that's where he retreats to, because I think his core base has goals, and he's meeting those goals. I don't think he's providing real solutions to them. I think those are folks who are worried about their wages and their jobs and their homes and their children's future, as they should. And the country should address those needs, but they should be addressed in a sustained and mature way. And that's not how Trump's addressing them.
Bob Woodward's book, Fear, is out today. This is without question, regardless of whether you know or don't know Bob Woodward or what you think of him. You cannot question his journalistic ethics. The book lays out in frightening detail what a mess, what a hot, horrible mess the White House is from the inside out. The op-ed in the New York Times last week echoed that as well. And we talked to Chuck Todd, another friend of the show, last week about this, and just saying that I'm concerned, and I'd be curious to see if you share this concern, Tim, that too much of the conversation is about who wrote it as opposed to the content of what's in it.
I would completely agree with that. I think the reason people are focusing on who wrote it is because the White House has I think put that front and center as a debating point. I would note that Bob Woodward is not a liberal Democrat. He's not a Democrat, nor is he a liberal. Bob Woodward's a Republican. The person who wrote the anonymous op-ed in the New York Times was a member of the Trump Organization, a Republican who said he or she was in that White House because he or she wanted tax cuts and deregulation, among other policy concerns. Those are core conservative policy concerns. So these aren't people from the other side of the ideological divide taking cheap shots at the president. The other thing I would point out is the White House, President Trump, and Melania Trump, among others, have all bemoaned that op-ed was written by an anonymous individual, and that Bob Woodward has relied on some anonymous sources in his book. Everyone should remember that the president is a 72-year-old man who has spent the better part of five decades anonymously leaking damaging information and gossip about friends, competitors, and his own family members, his ex-wives, gossip pages and media organizations. He has played this card repeatedly himself. And in the past, when he hasn't liked what the news portends, he has then engaged in mole hunts to try to get at the sources of information that he doesn't agree with. But this is right out of his own playbook. The difference being here is, I think that the anonymous writer of the op-ed at the Times felt like there's a car crash going on in the White House, which anyone who's been watching this White House since he got elected knows to be true. Bob Woodward has created a document around that. There's nothing really new in Bob Woodward's book. Most of the media has been saying this for the last year and a half, but I think in some ways the media right now, you know, the White House, and I think the general population's take on the media is that, you know, it's like Renfield in Dracula, you know, this crazy guy in the asylum who's saying there's a monster there and no one pays attention because he's nuts. And I hope as a country we get past that, too.
We need to. We have to. And thank you. And my best to you and everybody in New York this morning, because it's a special day for all of us, but certainly closest to home for you. So thank you for being on.
Thanks for having me, Steve and Justin.
It is Bloomberg Opinion Executive Editor Tim O'Brien at BO Opinion on Twitter and all over social media. And that's Tim O'Brien. The amazing story that some of you may not know about Gander, Newfoundland, before we get to the news at the top of the hour. And then Dean will talk a little show business coming up and wrap up the Toronto Film Festival. There is a play that was a wildly successful play on Broadway. I don't even know if it's still up, called Come From Away. And Come From Away is the story of Gander, Newfoundland, and the people that ended up in Gander, Newfoundland on 9/11.
Yeah.
When airspace was shut down all over America on Tuesday morning, September 11th, 2001. One story in particular stands out, and it's told by a flight attendant on a plane that was crossing from Frankfurt headed towards the United States. They were about 5 hours out of Frankfurt, flying over the North Atlantic. And as soon as they got over the Atlantic, deeply over the Atlantic, I suppose, the flight attendant was told to go into the cockpit immediately. The captain handed the flight attendant a note that said, it was from Delta's main office in Atlanta. It said, all airways over the continental United States are closed to commercial air traffic. Land ASAP at the nearest airport. No one said a word about what it could mean. We knew it was serious. The captain determined that the nearest airport was 400 miles away in Gander, Newfoundland. He requested approval for a route change, got it immediately. When the flight crew prepared the airplane for landing, another message arrived telling us about terrorist activity in the New York area. And then word came in about the hijackings. We decided to lie to the passengers that were on the plane that we had a mechanical problem. There was some grumbling, but it wasn't until we landed that we explained what happened. There were about 20 other airplanes on the ground. When we got there, many more would follow. After we parked on the ramp, the captain made the following announcement. Ladies and gentlemen, you must be wondering if all these airplanes have the same instrument problem as we have. The reality is we're here for another reason, and then he went on to explain what had happened. The Canadian government was in charge of our situation. No one was allowed to get off the plane. No one on the ground was allowed to come near us. Only airport police were able to come by periodically and look over our plane before they moved on to the next. In the next hour or so, finally 53 planes from all over the world landed in this tiny town of Gander, Newfoundland. Meanwhile, bits of news started to arrive. People tried to use their cell phones but couldn't because this was 2001 and technology was such that all you could get was a Canadian operator, if you could get anything at all, telling you that you can't call the United States. There were lots of tears as people tried to figure out how to let their family know they were okay. We had been told earlier that there would be allowing people off the planes one plane at a time. And finally, at 6 p.m., the Gander Airport told us that our plane could deplane, but not until 11 o'clock the next morning. Passengers were unhappy, but we coped, and they were true to their word. We had no medical situations to worry about. We had a young lady who was 33 weeks into her pregnancy. We took really good care of her. And about 10:30 on the morning of the 12th, a convoy of school buses showed up. We got off the plane. We were taken to the terminal. Processed and sent out who knows where. We had no idea where our passengers could go, but we do know that people in the town with a population of 10,400 opened up their homes, opened up every hotel, motel, and inn, and we were told to relax, that we would find out what we could do soon. The total scope of the terror back home was available on our TV, and we were less than 24 hours after it started. Meanwhile, we had lots of time on our hands. 2 days into this at the Gander Airport, We had been shown the greatest hospitality you can imagine as everyone in Gander, Newfoundland, including high school students who were told they were volunteering to help us, made us comfortable, fed us, made sure we had something to eat and drink, and listened to us talk about our families as we talked about theirs. Gander and all the surrounding communities had closed all high schools, meeting halls, lodges, any other large gathering places, and converted all of them into mass lodging areas. 218 passengers ended up in a town called Lewisport. That was our plane, Delta 15. Families were kept together. Finally, as we know, we were able to leave, but not without being incredibly touched by the generosity of the people of Newfoundland. It was absolutely incredible. When the passengers finally came back on board to go to the United States, there was one who asked if he could make a PA announcement. It's something we never, ever did, but these were different times. And that passenger stood up and said that he wanted to start a fund to help the people of Lewisport who had done so much for them. He called it the Delta 15 Fund. He was a successful businessman who matched all of the money we raised on the plane. And just by passing the hat, literally, we raised $14,000 before we took off. That was in the form of names and numbers and donations. The gentleman, an MD, a doctor from Virginia, matched those donations to make it $28,000. As of 2016, the last known record of the fund prior to this article being published, a trust fund of nearly $2 million assisted nearly 150 kids in Lewisport to see their way through college. It reminds us how much good there is in the world. In spite of all the rotten things we keep hearing about, a story like this confirms that there's good and good people everywhere, and everybody comes forward when they're needed. It's a fact. It's a great story. And it led to the Broadway play, Come From Away.
And Texter 317 said there's a documentary on that, and they're showing it to their students today.
Yeah, that's very cool. Yeah. All right, we'll come back. Dean in a moment. News next, 720 WGN. Oh, and don't forget, kids, Steve Grzanich is in that Northwestern Medicine newsroom with the stories that matter coming up next on WGN Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen,
Dean Richards joins us from Channel 9.
Citizens of the world.
Some of the world's greatest entertainers are here tonight.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I present to you?
And tonight, guess what? It's going to be Dean.
Yeah, honey, you know I love you more than what I should.
Back from Toronto, still smelling like Canadian bacon.
Yeah, hey there.
It's Dean Richards live at Channel 9. There you go. Hey, I got several things to ask you about, but I just want to get a couple more of these texts in.
I'm busy writing my rundown for our spontaneous comments.
Right? This is the thing, the notes you sent me?
These are the notes that I send you. I'm very busy writing them.
Well, think about this while
go ahead while you're
think about this while you write where you were this morning 17 years ago, because here's a few listeners. 317, I was teaching in Hawaii. We immediately drove to Pearl Harbor, sat there, looked at the harbor, and cried. 312, 9/11's my birthday. I think of people born on 12/7. We have a strange brother and sisterhood. 847, I was at Great Lakes Naval Station providing training as a civilian on lockdown after the towers hit. Amazing to watch the military gear up to protect our shoreline. Not able to enter the base for 2 months due to security when I was allowed to return. Sandbags, cement walls, guns at every entry. But God bless our military. 815, we met 10, this is a cool story, met 10 special ops troops on a wilderness canoe trip in Canada on 9/14. They were completely off the grid. When we told them what had happened, they didn't believe us. We then found out a month later they had been picked up at the border by, quote, special air and went straight into the fight. Don't know what happened to them. Mm-hmm. And then, I think of this, Steve Buscemi. Steve Buscemi, Dean, as you know, was a New York firefighter.
Right.
And he got right to the pile and started working with his fellow firefighters that day. So there's
Pete Davidson, you know, from SNL,
yep,
who's now, you know, probably best known for being Ariana Grande's fiance. His father was killed in the World Trade Center. He was he worked at the restaurant.
Amazing stories, just amazing stories on this 9/11.
I heard you talking about listening to Spike and hearing Spike, you know, talking about what a beautiful day it was and
how slow a news day it was.
I was already in the office that morning, sitting in the office. I had Spike on the speakers, and you know, in just about every office we have a TV set on, and the TV was on, and I saw the towers and the smoke coming out right after it happened. And I was talking to somebody on the phone. I said, some idiot just crashed what I thought, and everybody was saying, must have been a small plane that crashed into the towers. I said, some idiot crashed into the towers. And I'm continuing to watch, and then I saw the second plane crash into the second tower. And I said some words that I can't repeat right now, and I said, we're being attacked.
Right.
Oh, my God, we're being attacked.
You know what really struck me? I mean, obviously, it was horrific, but it really didn't strike me as oh, my God, we got to do something right now until the Pentagon was hit.
Yeah.
Because all bets were off, and we knew there was at least one plane still in the air at that point, if not more. And there were hours and hours of not being sure what was going to happen that day, let alone what was going to happen next, because the president didn't speak until early in the evening when he insisted that he be brought down from on Air Force One somewhere because the American people needed to hear from him. Yeah,
it was awful. I mean, remember that video of the President George W. Bush talking to the reading story to the elementary students at the point at which one of his aides whispered into his ear.
Andrew Card.
Apparently told him what was going on, how eerie it was that when all air traffic stopped and how quiet it was.
What do you remember? Peter Jennings was so brilliant.
Yeah, that night, the whole night.
Peter Jennings did like 14 hours with only one sweater change. And I remember they showed the radar just filled with tiny dots. Everyone representing an airplane, and a second later, it was blank.
What amazed me as well is to think that that's how we wanted so much information. Everybody around this country wanted information, why, what, who, everything involved, and there was no Twitter, there was no Facebook, there was nothing at that time. So you went to shows like Peter Jennings, and you watched the scroll, and that was the beginning of, to me, this idea of continuing repetitive information.
Yeah, the 24-hour news cycle.
And it was the same information. They didn't have anything to update you on, and you were just like, I want something new. If there was Twitter at that time, oh my gosh.
Well, thank God there wasn't.
So many fake stories.
Thank God there wasn't.
Well, especially with the kids in school. That was so scary. I mean, I had an eighth grader, a fifth grader, and a kindergartner at the time, and I mean, I was here, and you know, I was just like, I got to get out of here. I got to get home. I got to go be with my kids and get them in my house and be safe. And it was, you know, but I wanted to be here, too, to help, you know, with news or whatever, and it was
there was a lot of talk also that Chicago also might be targeted, that Sears Tower might
and
also
the Tribune
be a
Tower when we
and
were there.
Tribune Tower. Remember,
yes.
we were all sitting around the building. I mean, it was cryptically quiet.
Well, we were told by the Secret Service. We were told by the Secret Service that the two targets that they knew were on terrorist lists to be hit were the Sears Tower, still called the Sears Tower then, followed by the Tribune Tower. And the reason is because the Chicago Tribune and WGN Radio are right there, major media sources, big attack. And the concern was always that a bus would roll up right out in front of the bus station and blow up. The amazing thing is that stuff we don't hear. For the last 17 years, the stories you don't hear, if you knew all of them, if you knew what the presidential daily brief said, good Lord, you wouldn't sleep a wink at night. So thank you for everyone.
It was
from a local cop to the guys in Washington and the men and women who serve us to protect us.
It was just so sad watching that. And I posted on my Facebook, remember those blue lights that they put up in the sky in New York City? I just happened to be in New York exactly 6 months after when they first illuminated those blue lights that simulated the towers. I was walking by the World Trade Center site, and I saw, something's going on. I didn't know that they were going to turn the lights on, but I saw Giuliani, I saw the mayor, I saw, you know, people who on a stage. So I stopped, and it was the ceremony when they turned these lights on, and I was standing amidst hundreds and hundreds of people who were, remember how people would hold pictures of their relatives?
Yeah,
has anyone
absolutely.
Seen my relative? I'm standing in the middle of that crying. Like,
of course you are.
It was one of the most moving and profound things when it stopped being a television story, and you're standing next to people whose relatives were killed in this rubble that was right in front of you.
I want to hear about the Toronto Film Festival, and I want to hear about you being
you
Billy Joel. I
want to hear around Chance the Rapper, too.
All right, I want to hear about all of it. Stand by.
That was the transition of the century, by the way.
There's no way to get out of it, so we just get out of it. Hope you kids are paying attention at home. All right, stand by.
Broadcasting going on right here.
The pros.
Professionalist.
Stand by. More of this segment and, sponsored by Brand New Smile. Again, that's a Brand New Smile Dental Implant Center.
Dean Richard, the entertainment editor, Channel 9720.
All right, let's talk as Toronto wrapped up. Anything we don't know?
No, really, we nothing else to share with you.
All right, that's the wrap-up from Toronto. There's nothing else.
What we talked about yesterday. After we spoke, I talked to Susan Sarandon. We had a very nice interview about her movie. She did not. And then I went to the airport. I ate a small bag of peanuts and got on the airplane.
We shared to the Steve Cochran Show page the picture that Dean posted of Lady Gaga kissing his hand. Mm. So people can go to Steve Cochran Show Facebook.
How was that?
Kissed my hand and gave me a hug, too.
She sincerely, not that I doubted your story, but I mean, she's very engaged with you, Dean.
I was telling her about what her music meant and thanked her for. I told her that I'd seen her in concert many times, that I saw her with Tony Bennett, and that her music is more than just pop music, and she's more than just someone who pranced around in a meat suit at one time. Her music has validated people and made people feel like they are not unusual. She made people feel good about herself.
Yeah, it's true.
And that's when she went in for the big hug and gave me a little kiss on my hand.
Dean and Lady Gaga sitting in a tree. K-I-S-S-I-N-G. Jealous. I'm very mature.
Jealous.
Yeah, a little bit.
Jealous.
Smokey and the Bandit this weekend?
Smokey and the Bandit is, they're going to release it into big screen theaters in honor of Burt Reynolds. It will open today and run through September the 20th. $5 to see Smokey and the Bandit.
Well, and to see a guy on a CB radio is worth it. I'd pay $6 for that.
And the great Jackie Gleason.
He was so good.
Sally Field. Those are great roles.
Sly Stallone's going to do a Rambo remake. Are they doing this in a nursing home, or what are they doing?
It's a little different. It's a little more different now with a walker. But they still, the movie's going to be 5 hours.
When walkers clash.
This is Texas Walker Rangers. No, he said on Instagram that they're going to start production. It was rumored that this was going to happen, that he was going to bring back the Rambo franchise. But on Instagram last night, he said they're going to start production soon. It's definitely going to happen.
What do we know about the W.C. Fields comeback? Is that still on paper?
Carrot Top is still in negotiations to take over that role.
John Legend in the news?
John Legend, the creative Emmy Awards were given out the other night. These are not the major awards. That's going to be this coming Monday.
I win any of those?
You did not win anything, unfortunately.
I'm striking out, man.
But John Legend did, though. He won an Emmy Award for his participation in the musical Jesus Christ Superstar that was phenomenal. The whole thing was phenomenal, but he was amazing. He won an Emmy Award, which is significant because now he is an EGOT winner. Emmy, yeah. Grammy, Oscar, and Tony Award winner.
That's amazing.
And he is the first, he's the youngest person ever to achieve that, and the first black male ever to.
And he's married to a Sports Illustrated swimsuit model, so he's doing pretty well.
And so what do you do, when you get the EGOT? First of all, you win an Emmy Award, which is cool. You become the youngest EGOT winner ever, the first black male ever. How do you celebrate? Probably some wild after parties? No. He went home with his wife, Chrissy Teigen, and he made pancakes for the whole family.
That's what I like to hear. That's a good story.
That's a great story, isn't
it? Yeah, that really is. Kanye West is going to teach at the Art Institute. Bring your children.
That's what he tweeted.
Oh.
He tweeted that out the other day, that he was going to teach at the Art Institute, and that he was going to bring back a comedy jam to Chicago. The Art Institute yesterday begs to differ with him. They tweeted by saying they're very honored that he would be interested in that, but there are no plans for Kanye to be teaching at the Art Institute at this time. There is a comedy jam that's coming to Chicago. Kanye West is not on that itinerary. The Sun-Times today has a cover story about Kanye and other rap stars bringing back the old Regal Theater, which is the old Avalon Theater on 79th Street. It's a beautiful old, one of these beautiful old movie palaces that pretty much has been closed for about 8 or 9 years. It's on and off been open, but it needs to be completely renovated. But he apparently is involved in all of that until tomorrow when somebody tweets that that's not true.
Is he coming back to Chicago? What's the interest in all these Chicago projects?
Well, all the things that he tweeted about so far are not true.
Well, maybe he thinks they're happening.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
I think Justin didn't. Our inside person told us they thought he was coming back here.
There's a lot of rumblings, Dean. You know rumblings.
But I believe that inside person also didn't care too much if he did or didn't.
Yeah, but yeah. There's rumblings that Connie is thinking about coming back and setting up shop here in Chicago.
And remember, if you have rumblings, get to a doctor quickly. Chance the Rapper running for mayor?
Chance was in Chicago last night. His first big screen role debuted last night. It's a horror movie that's called Slice. It's described as a pizza delivery horror movie. That's all I know about it.
Is the horror that, like, you open the box and the cheese slid off the pizza?
I think the horror is that they actually made the movie. That may be the issue. But he was on the red carpet, and we've always had nice conversations with him and everything. We talked about the movie, and we talked about him transitioning to acting. But, you know, he has been super critical of Mayor Emanuel. He has been super critical of politics in Chicago, super critical of anything being done about violence in Chicago. His name has come up over and over and over again since Mayor Emanuel announced he is not going to be running for mayor, that because Chance has been so vocal about it. Will Chance run for mayor? So on the red carpet last night, I asked him about that.
Wow, that's a loaded question. I would say, firstly, it is a terrible, I don't know. I think you started off with that, and then you went into the mayoral question. I feel like maybe we should just talk about Slice.
Would you think about running for mayor, or like what are the attributes that you think the next mayor should have?
Sorry, no comment.
Oh yeah, so
what
now,
is that about?
Now no comment.
What is that about? Why not just answer the question?
This PR person couldn't have grabbed him and pulled him away from me fast.
It's not like Secret Service. They threw themselves on him. Yeah. Hey, a lot of people are asking, where can I see Dean as Billy Joel on the Pat Tomasulo thing? Is it on the WGN TV website?
I think it is. There's a Man of the People is the name of Pat's show.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one where he took me around. We pretended that I was Billy Joel, and almost everybody bought it. So if you Google Man of the People, Billy Joel,
you'll find it.
You'll be able to find that. It's pretty funny.
You were so good, man. Okay. I just thought you were hilarious.
I think you should get an EGOT.
I belly laughed at the EGOT winner.
We were laughing. Pat and I watched it on the couch. He saw the tweet on Saturday night or whatever, and we were dying laughing. I sent you a text.
You were great, man. You were perfect.
And we'd like to continue to praise you, but we're out of time.
No, really. We have a few more minutes.
Oh, so short on time. It's very funny. Get the Rocky Wirtz book. Is it out yet? The Breakaway, Inside Story of Wirtz Family Business and the Chicago Blackhawks. Is it out today? We don't know. Dave, do we know when the book's actually being released?
I mean, I saw copies of the book yesterday at the golf outing, so I know it's been published.
And a helpful texter. I would highly agree with this texter recommending Jeff Daniels playing a man named John O'Neill in the Hulu 9/11 story, The Looming Tower, which is an amazing story. I'd love to give up the ending for you because can't believe it, but it would ruin it for you. The Looming Tower.
You know, of course, I'm extremely nervous. I might be looking at the possibility of spending the rest of my life in prison for, you know, doing my job as I was trained as a Chicago police officer.
Steve Gochran Show here on 720 WGN with you till 10 o'clock. Steve has left the building. He is going to funeral services today for John DeCosta's father. And we'll talk more with John about that. He died this weekend. Yeah, so we send condolences. 93 years old.
Gene DeCosta, he was a legend, worked with Wilson Sports for 50 years. So a lot of people know who he is.
So we will talk to John about his father later in the week, but we send condolences. Steve is representing the team today at the services. Well, of course, we continue to talk about remembrances and get our listeners' thoughts on 9/11 this
tragic anniversary, 17 years, 312-981-7200. Locally, we have been talking about the trial of Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke. Of course, Jason Van Dyke on trial for the murder of Laquan McDonald. A lot of heyday around the jury selection, which was yesterday and continues tomorrow. They're not in court today. Ryan Burroughs covering for WGN. He joins us now. Ryan, good to see you.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. We've been in talks about getting on to talk about this at some point, so I'm glad we were able to make
it work today. I'm glad to have you here. This is awesome. All right, so let's talk about this, because I saw the stories this morning. Five jurors have been selected already, which is surprising in the way that there was a lot of question about whether or not there would be any impartial juror, but they have selected five for this trial.
Yeah, it went through 19 yesterday. They brought 19 people in, sat them in. Judge Vincent Gaughan was the one who was leading these discussions. And of course, obviously, the prosecution and defense, you know, had their say and leading some of the questions and how they were answered. And pretty much what we got out of this is all 19 were aware of this case. You know, the question is, have you seen the video, and can you be fair seeing that video and then going into this trial? Have you already created an opinion? Right. And what in your background may or may not sway you one way. By the way, those questionnaires that 200 people filled out, 106 questions. It was a 27-page questionnaire filled out. And I mean, the questions span, you know, everything from, you know, your history of violence in your life to whether or not you have bumper stickers and what kind of bumper stickers.
Is that how it works? So I've only been selected at one point for a jury, and I remember going into the courtroom where they ask you these questions. This is a little bit more unusual in the sense that this is in a room, judge's quarters somewhere, a conference room with a table and the lawyers around, and Jason Van Dyke is in there. Tell us a little bit about how that process
You know, we got the information from the pool reporters who went in. Basically, there were two print reporters and then one TV reporter who got in, so they were just kind of feeding this to us. Yeah, but the way people are situated, whether they can see Van Dyke, whether they can't see Van Dyke, is very interesting the way it's kind of set up. But Judge Gaughan is the one who's essentially leading the discussion, and then the prosecution defense get to ask questions, and things got a little testy between Gaughan and the defense, Herbert. They've been kind of testy for the last few weeks, but Herbert continues to threaten that, you know, this could end up being a bench trial after all, and that he's not happy with the way the questioning's going. He's not happy with the way the judge is leading these. So,
and that's the question, because these questionnaires, you could see, they say you could see bias in the questionnaires, and the judge, they say that the judge is rehabilitating the possible jurors by changing, re-asking the question or possibly going deeper on the question to say, oh, they're okay.
And Judge Gaughan is not someone who's going to take criticism like that lightly. I mean, he's a hard, rear end, I guess, when it comes to these kind of these kind of things. He doesn't like these flip comments, and he lets the Van Dyke's attorney know he doesn't like
that. The big two issues for the defense, one, they believe they cannot get a fair trial in Cook County. They cannot get a fair trial because everybody has seen the video in Chicago. They want it outside of Cook County. The second is that they possibly, because of the same issue of not having a fair, what they consider to be an impartial juror, they would just go to a bench trial. A bench trial would mean that a judge would decide the fate of...
And it would be Judge Gaughan, the guy who he's been ticking off in all of this. So, you know, obviously they've got two cards up their sleeve. Number one, they believe, and the clock is ticking. You've got five jurors seated right now. Once you get to, you know, the 12 plus the, actually, once you get to 12, the decision is out of the hands of the defense as to whether or not it can be a bench trial. Then it goes to the judge. And at this point, the judge is going full steam ahead. So it doesn't necessarily seem like Judge Gaughan has any intention of letting this go to a bench trial if it gets
to
that 12th juror.
They could go to 10 jurors and then we don't like what we see, and we could pull the code.
And the other issue that's come up as far as whether or not it's a fair trial, and it's something that's come up in these questionnaires, is, you know, there are demonstrators outside and they're chanting, they've got bullhorns, and we can hear them from the fifth floor. They apparently can't hear them inside of the courtroom, but, you know, these jurors got to walk by these signs and the chants, you know, every time they go inside and outside of the courtroom. Is that impacting how they feel? Is it impacting their safety? You know, and that's something that is constantly being brought up as
Ryan
well.
Ryan Burrow, WGN Radio, he's covering the Jason Van Dyke trial. trial down at 26 in California for us, and I'm assuming ABC News as well. All right, let's just take a break real quick, and we'll continue with Ryan because I want to ask about the what's happening outside the courtroom, and also you know more about the jury selection here on the Steve Cochran Show.
Back to the Steve Cochran Show.
720 WGN 312-981-7200. We'll read some more of your memories and remembrances today in 9/11, 17 years since 9/11. Ryan Burrows in studio. We're talking about the case, of course, Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke and the killing of Laquan McDonald. Their jury selection is underway. Five jurors have been selected. There needs to be 12 jurors and four alternates. They continue that process tomorrow. Ryan, one of the ways that the defense seemed to bring up objections about whether or not this trial should be fit for Cook County was that jurors would be worried about if they went for an acquittal, they would be worried about starting a riot, that Chicago would riot. And this is something that the judge is not having.
No, and there are questions on the questionnaire too about, you know, do you fear for your own safety and things like that, and they answered that. But it seems as though the more and more that those questions are explored by the defense, kind of hinting, hey, you know, is it possible you're scared? Are you scared? The judge is not interested. And that's been a point of contention as well as this moves forward. You know, does someone have the emotional and mental support to be able to handle this situation, knowing that there are protesters outside, knowing that everyone's watching this case, knowing that it's been on everyone's mind for 4 years?
There's also the reality of, I should be careful how I say this, but the effect of the celebrity juror, you know, after watching those shows that we just watched that were on the O.J. Simpson trial, you know, they like get kind of...
Are they aware of that? Do they think about that a juror could say one thing in the questionnaire and do whatever they can to get on a high-profile case like this?
You know, from the perspective of the jury, they are being super protected right now. I mean, their names aren't even being said. That's why, you know, when we're getting this information on these five, we're getting, you know, Latina stay-at-home mom, probably in her 30s. You know, white male, probably in his 60s. I mean, we don't know if they're from the city, they're from the suburbs. I mean, they are really, really keeping this on lockdown. In fact, the judge said, if you name any of these jurors, and Herbert actually accidentally did, we think it was accidental, you could be fined $200 for the first time, $300 the second time, and then, you know, so more extensive punishment beyond that. So the judge said he'll take a look at the mistaken identity at one point. But, you know, I mean, they're talking about the potential that these jurors are sequestered in a hotel. And if that's the case, now you've got a mother of three who could be sequestered away from her family for, you know, up to 3 weeks. I mean, that's an issue that's coming up here as well, and one of the reasons why a strike may be issued one way or another.
Well, when you say strike, what does that mean?
So basically, the defense and the prosecution have seven strikes. They're going through this pool of 200 potential jurors, and some of them can be dismissed for cause. One person was dismissed for cause because of a recent trauma that had happened in their lives. One of the women said that she thought that Van Dyke had shot excessively, and she believed that there was a cover-up among the police and the mayor. She was dismissed. No need to use a strike in that case. But if the judge seems okay with it and the prosecution seems okay, they can use that strike card. The defense can use that strike card.
Oh, they only get, I see,
they get seven of them. They've used three of them so
far. They each get seven.
Exactly. Yeah, and I believe the defense at this, or the prosecution at this point, has used one.
Ryan, my last question for you. Can you get a feel from the five jurors that have been selected and even the selection process of how you think a defense might be mounted, a prosecution might be mounted, any information that might be coming up in this upcoming trial?
Well, the one thing that I think the defense is trying to avoid is getting... Well, I don't want to say any African Americans, but they don't want this jury stacked with African Americans. And right now we see of the five, we've got a Latina, an Asian man, a white female, a white male, and another white female. And so if they can get to this 12, if they can hit that 12 point without any African Americans, I think that they would consider that a win.
So are they going to use their strikes, their seven strikes, on trying to get people of color off the jury?
It seems as though at least the strikes they've used to this point, that's been the rationale.
Ryan Burrow is covering for WGN Radio, and we will continue to check in with him during the Jason Van Dyke trial here at 26 in California. Ryan, thanks, bud.
Thanks.
All right, coming up, I've got so much to do here in the 9 o'clock hour. Adam Hoag's going to join us. Also, new Blackhawk, Brandon Manning. He just was painting the ice today. I'm excited to talk with him and Orion Samuelson as well, coming up later in the show. Coming up, the stories that matter with Steve Grzanich from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio.
Back to the Steve Cochran Show.
Rogers surveying, fires. That's caught. Randall Cobb into Chicago territory. Randall Cobb inside the 20-yard line. Randall Cobb is going to score. 75 yards. That is crazy.
Why?
Burton with Cohen in the backfield. Trubisky, look out, loses the ball.
Super Joe, I was ready for this conversation with Adam Hoge to be all about the positives that came out of the heartbreaking loss to Green Bay.
When was that?
The idea of what to be optimistic about as a Bears fan, and Super Joe picks those two highlights, two of the most pessimistic play or negative plays in Bears history.
Yeah, I mean, come on,
Randall Cobb play was disaster. Adam, am I right? I mean, that was shades of Chris Conte and the Super Bowl where Daniel Manning's in the wrong spot. It just felt like broken play when we were told there would be no broken plays with this defense.
Yeah, it's like any other time the Bears play the Packers, really, in the Aaron Rodgers era. It's like every time they play, somehow in the fourth quarter, he hits Jordy Nelson or Randall Cobb or whoever for a long pass, and this time it was Cobb again. And, you know, if we wanted to do the, you know, the whole optimistic approach thing, we probably should have pre-recorded this at halftime.
That's right. There were a lot. I want to focus on the positives. Adam Hoge, of course, covers the Bears. You can find all his great stuff all over the station, online, WGNradio.com/Bears. The game, of course, a heartbreaker for Chicago fans. We still are having a hard time getting over it. But there were some reasons for optimism, not just the first half. Let's first talk about the offense. It couldn't have gone any better for the offense in the first half, the first scripted drive.
And this is exactly what I wrote about on WGNRadio.com yesterday. I think any way you look at it, offense, defense, coaching, the overall outlook on the season, you can look, it's like 50-50. You can look at a lot of positives and say, hey, there's reasons for optimism, and then there's also reasons to be pessimistic. So offensively, we can start there. I mean, this game really started exactly how I thought it would. Nagy's offense is built in a way that when the Packers didn't know what was coming and they had months and months to prepare for, you know, putting together a script that worked for Mitch Trubisky and his strengths, I really felt confident the Bears were going to jump out to a lead in this game. What I didn't expect was the defense to blow it, which we can get to in a second. But offensively, I mean, it was like everything that was advertised all offseason in that first quarter, marching down the field twice, creativity, finding mismatches, quick throws, Trubisky reading everything properly. Unfortunately, if we're going to be pessimistic going forward, the Packers adjusted, and there was no response back. That's what I'm concerned about. I'm concerned about two things going forward. Specifically with Nagy and his coaching, why wasn't there an adjustment to the zone principles that the Packers changed to? Because there were a lot of man defense early. They switched to zone, and the Bears never really figured that out. That's not that complicated to figure out. And then the other thing I'm worried, and this is really the first time I've said this after a Mitch Trubisky start, and there's only been 13 of them. I wasn't impressed with how he read the field. Now, it's one game, and he's still young and inexperienced, so hopefully that improves going forward. But I just even watching the tape again, I'm like, something was just not good there with Mitch Trubisky.
You know, this offense promised to have answers when there were adjustments made, and as you just mentioned, it didn't seem like there were answers. Is this something that we should be concerned about?
Yeah, I mean, the only reason I am is because, again, I don't think the Packers were doing anything all that complicated. You know, another example is, okay, the third and one throw to Deion Sims early in the fourth quarter, which was kind of, you know, they tried to catch the Packers off guard and sneak Sims out to the left, and they thought he was going to be wide open, which would have worked if it was man defense. But it was zone. And Mitch, by his own admission, said that play doesn't work against zone. Well, isn't that something that we heard in this offense should be able to be read at the line of scrimmage? And if you know it's zone, then why is that play even being run? And also, why is it the only option? Because we keep hearing about RPOs and all these things where, okay, if you don't got the right look at the line of scrimmage, there's a check another option. And in such a key moment, they ran one play that just had one option, and it was against the wrong defense. That's concerning to me.
All right, what about the defense, Adam, and the second half performance and the way it slipped away? And specifically, you know, the one thing I think we had been expecting from this team was an improved pass rush this year. And we saw it in the first half. We didn't see it in the second half. We saw Aaron Rodgers clearly getting the ball out of his hand quickly. But is that an area where the Bears failed to make an adjustment?
So, yeah, two things happened in the second half, and I really couldn't wait to get back into the tape and find out really why all of a sudden the pass rush just split. Okay, the first and obvious thing was that Aaron Rodgers couldn't move, so they really were trying to get the ball out of his hand quickly. Now, if there was a failure to adjust, there are two things, and I'm not so much concerned about this long term because Vic Fangio is a good defense coordinator, but he deserves to be knocked for this game. But the corners were playing way too far off. I mean, they was soft coverage, and that doesn't work when a quarterback is getting the ball, taking two steps, and throwing it. All right, so now I think what the Bears were thinking and Vic Fangio was thinking was, all right, we can allow all this stuff underneath. We got a 20-point lead. There's plenty, you know, we're just trying to get the clock to run out here. So Vic Fangio, who's typically a mix of conservative and aggressive, just sort of both coaches, I thought, Matt Nagy and Vic Fangio, were too conservative, specifically in the third quarter. And we saw that defensively there. Now, the other thing was, it's not like every play Rodgers was two steps and the ball was gone. I mean, there were some scramble plays, even though he was hobbled. And on those plays, Khalil Mack didn't get there. Akeem Hicks didn't get there. Now, a couple things were going on. Hicks, I think, has a knee issue and did not look right in the second half to me. That's concerning to me going forward. And then second, Khalil Mack, look, he wasn't out there in the preseason. He didn't get a training camp. I don't think he was fully in football shape. So the guy we saw in the first half wasn't quite the same guy we saw in the second half. Now, he'll get into football shape quickly. Trust me, he's a hard worker. And, oh, my God, was he the best player we've seen in a Bears uniform in a really, really long time since Brian Urlacher retired. So that is something to be incredibly excited about going forward.
Well, we'll continue to watch this and continue to talk about the Chicago Bears.
And I saw the Bears are going to honor Brian Urlacher at the game against Seattle next Monday. So I'm just thinking out loud here, Adam. I mean, he's going to be there anyway, right?
Well, hey, hopefully Roquan Smith is ready to play a little bit more, too.
Yeah.
And instead they could go to the rookie who they hope is a future Hall of Famer. They don't have to go back to 54.
In only eight plays, there were a lot of glimpses there of the future. All right, so we will continue with Adam throughout the week. WGNradio.com/Bears. You can find all this stuff. Adam, thanks for joining us, bud.
All right, thanks, guys.
All right, there you go. Adam Hogue on the Bears. Coming up, defenseman Brandon Manning is going to join us from the Chicago Blackhawks. Talk about training camp starting on Friday. How great is that? And he today was busy.
Going all sports here.
All right, there we go.
Giroux finds Manning, takes the shot, and fires a save made. Going down the other side, he scores! Brandon Manning from injured reserve onto the scoreboard.
Here come the Hawks, the mighty Blackhawks.
Training camp starts this Friday. Training camp festival at the United Center on Saturday. The Chicago Blackhawks back on the ice just in time. It's been a pretty bad week for Chicago sports with the Kopech news on the south side.
The Cubs
back into a race with the Brewers. The Bears game, we are looking for Blackhawks hockey. One guy that's hoping to help the team came over from the Philadelphia Flyers this offseason. The new Chicago Blackhawks defenseman, Brandon Manning, joins us on the line now. Brandon, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me in.
So first off, what a great honor to be. Yesterday, there was a lot of news coverage and the honor of you getting to paint the ice and the Blackhawks logo at center ice. What was that experience like to start your career with the Chicago Blackhawks?
Yeah, it's pretty cool, I think, you know, to see the kids out there for the Future Goals, you know, Foundation, and show some initiative into, you know, the community and obviously into the Blackhawks is pretty cool. And then, I mean, for me, it's the first time, you know, I've been on the ice essentially as a Blackhawk and not as a part of another team. So, you know, when we step out there this weekend with the Fan Fest going on Saturday, I think, you know, it's something I'm going to remember kind of all season. It was the first time on the ice was being a part of painting that logo.
Are you an artistic guy, Brandon?
Not so much, no. You know, I'd probably leave that to my girlfriend. But with the help of the kids, I think we did a pretty good job, and it was a really cool experience.
A couple of years ago, they had all the Hawks, like Jonathan Tays and them, they painted and then they made them Christmas cards. Remember, we got Christmas cards we can send out. So maybe now that you've done the ice, they'll enlist you to put together their next Christmas card box.
Yeah, I'll have to step up my game now and, you know, work on that a little bit for you guys.
You know, training camp coming up here on Friday, of course, the festival on Saturday. But for you to come over to this team, what's it mean for you to sign with the Chicago Blackhawks? Talk about your career playing against us, but also, you know, getting ready for the 2018-2019 season.
Yeah, I was pretty fortunate to play in a special organization like Philadelphia there. Obviously a great sports city. And then, you know, to come over to, you know, a world-class organization in the Blackhawks and, you know, try to continue what they've been a part of for, you know, the last 6-7 years and help them get into the playoffs. You know, there's world-class players here and a lot of good pieces still with young guys coming up. So, you know, hopefully it's pretty easy to step into, you know, a lineup like that. And, you know, it makes it easy when you have guys like that around you.
There are a lot of young guys coming up. You've been around the league a little bit, but you're not certainly not the oldest guy on this team. What can you, what have you picked up just being around them a little bit from guys like Duncan Keith and Brent Seabrook who have been here for a long time?
Yeah, I think, you know, I've been here for a couple weeks now full time, and, you know, I think the first thing you notice is obviously, you know, their character and what kind of guys they are. And then, you know, the second thing, just, you know, talking to them or, you know, hearing the way they talk about hockey is, you know, they believe they can win every year and they've done it before. And, you know, obviously a disappointing season last year for them, but, you know, I really think they believe they can win every single year and have a chance. And, you know, be a part of that and included in that is pretty special.
Brandon, I know you said you've been here for a few weeks and you've probably been enjoying this city a lot. We played golf yesterday with Cliff Coral, and I know some other alumni like Troy Murray have told us there used to be a rule that the Blackhawks weren't allowed to live in the city, that they had to live in the suburbs. Can you imagine coming here and not being allowed to live in the actual city?
Yeah, I mean, for me, the whole city life is going to be a little new for me. You know, I come from a small town up north in British Columbia, but, you know, it's pretty cool. There's lots of good restaurants, lots of stuff going on. Like I said, it's a great sports city. You know, you can bounce around to football games or ball games. So, you know, I'm definitely kind of just taking it all in right now and trying to enjoy as much as I can until, you know, we get going full swing here.
All right, the training camp festival is at the UC on Saturday,
11 a.m.
11 a.m.
First 10,000 fans get an Alex DeBrincat bobblehead. So, Brandon, you might want to get there early.
I might have to snag a couple of those. Those might be worth something in a few years.
That's right. You can find tickets at ChicagoBlackhawks.com. Also, training camp starting on Friday. Chicago Blackhawks back on the ice here in Chicago. Brandon Manning will be a part of that squad. Brandon, thanks so much for taking some time out to talk to us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot, guys. Appreciate it.
There you go. Brandon Manning. Comes from the Flyers. I mean, that could be a huge part of the Chicago defense.
Well, look, he's here. It's an area of need for the Blackhawks. That's the main thing, and they feel that he can come in and help them. So yeah. We'll see.
9:34, here's Steve Grzanich.
We're going to take you now to Shanksville, Pennsylvania, where President Trump is now speaking at the 9/11 commemoration in Shanksville, Pennsylvania.
Who were murdered on this day 17 years ago. We're here to pay solemn tribute to the 40 passengers and crew members on Flight 93 who rose up, defied the enemy, took control of their destiny, and changed the course of history. Today we mourn their loss, we share their story, and we commemorate their incredible valor. On September 11th, 2001, a band of brave patriots turned the tide on our nation's enemies and joined the immortal ranks of American heroes. At this memorial on this sacred earth, in the field beyond this wall, And in the skies above our heads, we remember the moment when America fought back. Melania and I are grateful to be joined for today's ceremony by Governor Tom Wolf and Governor Mark Schweiker. I also want to thank the members of Congress in attendance, Senator Bob Casey, Congressman Lou Barletta, Keith Rothkus, Bill Schuster, and along with the president of the families of Flight 93, Gordon Felt. We're also joined by members of the National Park Service, along with firefighters, first responders, and incredible people from law enforcement. These are truly great people. Some of you here today answered the call and raced to this field 17 years ago. You fill our hearts with pride, and I want to thank you on behalf of our country. Thank you very much. Most importantly, to the family members of Flight 93, today all of America wraps up and joins together. We close our arms to help you shoulder your pain and to carry your great, great sorrow. Your tears are not shed alone, for they are shared grief with an entire nation. We grieve together for every mother and father, sister and brother, son and daughter, who was stolen from us at the Twin Towers, the Pentagon, and here in this Pennsylvania field. We honor their sacrifice by pledging to never flinch in the face of evil and to do whatever it takes to keep America safe. Mm-hmm. 17 years ago, your loved ones were among the 40 of Flight 93, the 40 passengers and crew members on board the 8 a.m. United Airlines flight from Newark to San Francisco. They were men and women from every background. They were young people returning from visiting family, moms and dads on business trips, and friends going and coming from birthdays and weddings. They boarded the plane as strangers, and they entered eternity, linked forever, as true heroes. Soon after takeoff, Flight 93 was hijacked by evil men bent on terror and conquest. Passengers and crew members began using their phones to call home. They learned that two planes had already crashed into the World Trade Center in New York City. Immediately, those on board Flight 93 started planning a response. Sandy Bradshaw, a flight attendant, called her husband and told him they were in the back of the plane preparing hot water to throw onto the hijackers. Passenger Jeremy Glick explained the plan to his wife and said, "Stay on the line, I'll be back." The passengers and crew members came together, took a vote, and they decided to act. At that moment, they took their fate and America's fate back into their own hands. In the last 20 minutes, many placed their final calls home, whispering those eternal words, "I love you." Some said the Lord's Prayer, and then They bravely charged the cockpit. They attacked the enemy. They fought until the very end. And they stopped the forces of terror and defeated this wicked, horrible, evil plan. Flight 93 crashed yards from where we stand, just 20 minutes flying time from the United States Capitol. Through their sacrifice, the 40 saved the lives of countless Americans, and they saved our capital from a devastating strike. In the days after the attack, tens of thousands of firefighters, police officers, and recovery workers traveled to New York and Arlington to crawl through the rubble and search for survivors. There were prayer vigils, memorials, and charity drives all across our nation. Here in Shanksville, many of you raised up the first memorial, a wooden cross, a chain-linked fence, mementos and tributes pouring in, and dozens of American flags. A piece of America's heart is buried on these grounds. But in its place has grown a new resolve to live our lives with the same grace and courage as the heroes of Flight 93. This field is now a monument to American defiance. This memorial is now a message to the world. America will never, ever submit to tyranny. Since September 11th, nearly 5.5 million young Americans have enlisted in the United States Armed Forces. Nearly 7,000 service members have died facing down the menace of radical Islamic terrorism. Today, we also think of the more than 200,000 service members now serving overseas, and we think of every citizen who protects our nation at home, including our state, local, and federal law enforcement. These are great Americans. These are great heroes. We honor and thank them all. As Commander-in-Chief, I will always do everything in my power to prevent terrorists from striking American soil. Here with us today is Dorothy Garcia Blockler. Her husband, Sonny, was one of the passengers on Flight 93. On September 11th, 2001, just over a month after their 32nd wedding anniversary, Sonny was on his way back from a business meeting. He called Dorothy, who he loved so much, called her on the plane, and uttered her name before the line went dead silent. In the days after the attack, Dorothy told the investigators there was only one thing she wanted from this field: her husband's wedding ring. They would know it by the inscription etched inside. "All my love," it said, followed by the number 8269, the date of their anniversary. The officers, great people, promised to try, but in this field of records, it seemed certainly impossible. Dorothy began to pray, And she asked her friends to do the same. Days went by, then months. Still no ring. A week before Christmas, on December 19th, she heard a knock at the door. Two officers were standing with a really beautiful, to her, she saw it was so beautiful, she knew what was happening, a beautiful, small, white box. Inside it was a wallet, a luggage tag, a driver's license, a small bag with the wedding ring inscribed with those three precious words, "All my love." Those words echo across this field. And those words tell the story of 40 men and women who gave all their love for their families, their country, and our freedom. To Dorothy and to every family here today, America will never forget what your loved ones did for all of us. Earlier this week, you dedicated the final part of this memorial, the Tower of Voices. Standing at 93 feet tall, the Tower of Voices is now the first structure visitors see when they come to this now sacred ground. It will hold 40 beautiful chimes that ring throughout these fields, each a unique note, but all in perfect harmony. Each time we hear those chimes playing in the wind, we will remember the 40. We will remember their faces, their voices, their stories, their courage, and their love. And we will remember that free people are never at the mercy of evil, because our destiny is always in our hands. America's future is not written by our enemies. America's future is written by our heroes. As long as this monument stands, as long as this memorial endures, brave patriots will rise up in America's hours of need, and they too will fight back. Seventeen years ago, 40 incredible men and women showed the whole world that no force on earth will ever conquer the American spirit. We treasure their memory, we cherish their legacy, and we ask God to forever bless the immortal heroes of Flight 93. Thank you. God bless you. God bless the families, and God bless the United States of America. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much.
President Trump speaking outside Shanksville, Pennsylvania, at the memorial for Flight 93, Justin.
Yeah, wow. That's a stirring memory of what happened there in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. The president at a memorial service that's happening right now, and speaking about the people, the heroes, as he called it, that lost their lives protecting America. We'll have much, much more on remembering 9/11, 17 years since that fateful day. We also have great messages and people who are texting in about their experiences. 312-981-7200. All right, Bill and Wendy here on 720 WGN, taking over for Steve Cochran Show. Steve back tomorrow. We were asking for your 9/11 memories from that fateful day. And I got one I want to read because we got a lot of stuff we didn't get to because of the president's speech and other things that happened in the 9 o'clock hour. This coming from one of our listeners. My 9/11 story was I was living in central Illinois, a million miles away from everything. All my life, the U.S. was an invincible bubble. That morning, the bubble popped. Even though it was all east, we were hit at home. There's 300 million of us, but I selfishly felt like it was an attack on me. In my view of us as a country and our standing in the world, I felt alone and scared. The day after the news, I saw that the Star Spangled Banner was played at the Buckingham Palace. It wasn't played somberly or sad, it was played proudly. Knowing the history behind that song and why it was written, who was playing it, made it much more special. After watching that, I didn't think that everything was going to be okay, but I did think that we, at the very least, were not alone. It's a great sentiment on this day that we reflect on American history. Bill and Wendy are here in studio. Hey, guys. How's it going?
Hi. Morning.
Yeah, so what do you guys got coming up on the program?
A little bit of a continuation about the day and what the day means.
Yeah, really. I mean, so many people sending in their thoughts and their memories of the day, but also what it means to them, like that great story right there. I mean, it really is a profound and poignant day.
Would you agree with me, even though it was a horrible, horrible, horrible day, maybe one of the good things, maybe, that came out of it is kind of a new appreciation for what we have?
Yeah.
Don't you think?
Yeah, I think so. People always say it's a post-9/11 world, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wendy?
I feel like we appreciated it for a while.
Yeah, it may have dissipated
really
a bit.
And we shouldn't forget, we're going to talk to Tom Mikitas, professor of history at DePaul.
Great.
We're going to talk about how security has changed since 9/11 and other things as well.
It's just, I mean, we had conversations this morning, but just even thinking about just the way the news media has changed, just thinking about, I mean, all the
pre-Twitter,
security.
Yeah, pre-Twitter, I heard you mention that.
Yeah, I mean, just think about the protocols, the security protocols, not just, you know, in how you fly, but government buildings, federal buildings, all that kind of stuff. So it's all changed, yeah. All right, we'll have a great show.